We have a great panel of four speakers who will speak to the topic. And I just want to outline a little bit about the mechanics of the session, briefly introduce the speakers and hand over to them. Our four speakers will speak for around 5-6 minutes on the topic. And at the end of that presentation, I will moderate a discussion amongst the panelists, and I'll ask a series of questions. We'd also ask those listening into the conference to feel free to log a question on the chat line, and we'll try and weave those questions or the themes of those questions into the discussion as well. The session will run for an hour, and we look forward hopefully to your both interest and participation in the conference. Now, the invitation to the panel session contained a more extensive bio of each of our speakers, so I don't intend to spend a lot of time going through those, other than to say that they're all eminently qualified to talk to the subject. Brad Archer, as CEO of the Climate Change Authority, has had a long background in government policy in the area of energy and climate, and has been leading the Climate Change Authority for a few years here in Australia. He'll be followed by Guy Debelle, the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Guy's been very prominent in Australia in promoting, if you don't mind me saying, Guy, economic literacy amongst the community, and been a key contributor, a major contributor to important public policy or public debates around economic policy and the importance of a strong economy to our country. Jennifer Westacott has been involved in both public and private sector for many, many years, and has dealt with, and I know from experience, many of the thorniest issues to come across the table. Most recently, of course, the business response to the COVID pandemic, and of course, the enduring issue of climate change. And finally, we've got Stephen Fitzgerald, who's well known to Australians from his experience in the banking and finance sector, but particularly his role in founding and chairing Affirmative Investment Management, which has really been an early mover and leader in this topic. So with no further ado, I'd like to hand over to our first speaker, Brad Archer, and allow Brad to introduce the topic and the work of the CCA. Thank you, Brad. Over to you.
Thanks, Grant. So I think our starting point is that strong global action to reduce the risks of climate change is very much in Australia's interests. The latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Assessment Report on Climate Science makes abundantly clear that urgent action is necessary if the world is to have any chance of meeting the Paris Agreement goals. Global emissions have in fact risen since the Paris Agreement was struck, pausing only recently for the economic impacts of the response to the COVID-19 pandemic. However, in recent years, we have seen important trends emerging overseas and in Australia, and including in Australia's major trade and investment partners, trends that reflect businesses, consumers, and governments increasingly favouring lower emissions products and investment opportunities. So I think the first thing we can say is that's very welcome. But secondly, this increasing momentum towards net zero presents both challenges and opportunities for the Australian economy. A key theme of the Climate Change Authority's recent reports is that for Australia, these trends mean that reducing emissions as quickly as possible will be absolutely vital. And that's not just to play our part in addressing climate change, as we should, but for our economy to be competitive and to prosper as the world decarbonises. So what are these trends that we're seeing? Well, we're seeing large global funds managers, such as BlackRock, Macquarie, HSBC, and a host of others, adopting net zero by 2050 commitments for their investment portfolios. We've seen over 100 major banks and institutional investors place restrictions on lending to new coal projects. Companies are voluntarily adopting emissions reductions targets, and together with, or perhaps at the insistence of, financial regulators, are beginning to focus on managing climate-related risks. Sustainable debt financing has increased substantially, from around $30 billion US back in 2012 to around $730 billion US in 2020. And in terms of government responses, well, we're seeing the EU and others looking at taxing emissions intensive imports through such mechanisms as carbon border adjustment schemes. And governments also, such as in the UK, are deciding what qualifies as a green investment to guide flows of sustainable finance. Now, why are these trends important to Australia? Well, because quite simply, trade and investment are important for our economic performance. Our exports are equivalent to almost a quarter of our gross domestic product or total output. Now, when we think about the future of our exports, we have to note that some of our biggest export earners from the fossil fuel and farm sectors are highly emissions intensive. In fact, almost 40% of Australia's total domestic emissions are associated with the production of our exports. But that's not where the story ends. When our coal and gas exports are combusted overseas, the emissions are three times as much as the emissions that occur here in Australia in total. And we have other exports that also have high emissions downstream. For example, our iron ore and bauxite when turned into steel and aluminium. Now, in relation to investment, we are a net importer of capital, and more than one third of our foreign direct investment flows into our mining sector. So in a world that's increasingly taking strong action to decarbonise, reducing our own emissions is a necessary source of competitive advantage for our growth and our prosperity. It's necessary to attract the foreign capital we need and necessary to ensure our exports remain competitive. Now, these trade and investment trends are definitely coming off a low base. They have to strengthen and by a lot if the Paris Agreement is to be successful. The International Energy Agency has demonstrated the scale of the task, suggesting we require a tripling of global low carbon investment to around $2.4 trillion a year if we are to get to net zero by 2050. From an Australian perspective, these trends are already having an impact, and their importance for jobs and growth in our economy can only increase. The decisions being made overseas are just as important for us as the decisions we make here in Australia. The good news is that we have many opportunities in this global transition to net zero, starting with our extensive renewable energy resources, our deposits of critical minerals, which are important for clean technologies, and our vast landscapes. Now, the Australian government's latest emissions projections paint a fairly optimistic outlook for emissions to 2030. Most of this progress is happening in the electricity sector, with the strong continued growth in the share of renewables. And that lays a great foundation for reducing emissions elsewhere in the economy. And that's the challenge and the opportunity that we have to bend the curve more steeply for every other sector, to get emissions down, jobs and GDP up, and to get to net zero as soon as possible. So with that, I'll throw it back to you, Grub.
Thanks very much, Brad. And what we'd now like to do is pass the microphone, so to speak, on to Guy Debelle, Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Over to you, Guy.
Thanks very much, Grant. I'd like to pick up on some of the points that Brad just made in terms of the impact on Australian economy from the macro point of view. And then I just want to spend some time talking about the financial aspects that are very important in this space as well. But let me start on the macro side of things. So Brad very much highlighted a number of the transition challenges that the Australian economy faces as the world, and including Australia, transitions to net zero. But I'd also, before we think about the transition risks, I think it's also worth thinking about the physical risks to the Australian macroeconomy, which have been ever present, but are intensifying in recent years. And we've seen more and more evidence of climatic events having a material effect on the Australian macroeconomy and large enough to be a macro force rather than necessarily localised to local communities, which is devastating for them. But we're now starting to see it increasingly have large scale macro impacts with the bushfires being a very recent example, which probably still is strongly in people's minds. So we have those ever-present physical risks, which seem to be, which are getting larger and more intense and more frequent. But Brad also highlighted the transition risks as the world transitions to net zero. And one of the issues that I think is worth picking up on that Brad highlighted was really the impact of the policies of our trading partners, and particularly our trading partners in the energy space. So all of our trading partners who are all present in Glasgow now in one form or another have announced net zero policies. At the moment, we don't have strong idea as to how exactly they're going to implement those net zero policies, but we're expecting to get more and more granularity on that in the period ahead, if not even in the week ahead. And that will start to crystallise the transition risks that face the Australian economy, particularly in the energy export sector. But particularly in the fossil fuel energy export sector is where those costs are most likely to be prevalent. But at the same time, as Brad highlighted, we have the opportunity to still remain very much an energy exporter to the rest of the world, but energy exports of a different form, a renewable and sustainable form. And that opportunity is very much in front of us, and we are starting to see that being realised in different parts of the country. But there is plenty more scope for that to occur in the period ahead, and a large amount of opportunity there for us. But we do run the risk, if we drag our feet, that others will get there before us. And I think there is a large first mover, or at least early mover advantage, which we run the risk of squandering if we don't move ahead. So I think it's very important in this space to highlight the opportunity. A lot of this is always framed in terms of the cost. And there are two costs. There are definitely the costs, particularly to those local communities, of the impact of that transition. There's also the cost to the country as a whole of not doing anything, particularly of the world not doing anything. And that's manifest in the physical risks that we actually have seen play out in recent years. But at the same time, and including very much to the same communities where the costs may be borne the most, is often where the opportunities are the greatest. And I mentioned a couple of weeks back a good example of this, which is my home state of South Australia, where Port Augusta, which was very much on the receiving end of the cost of this transition, is now very much benefiting from it as it's moved very effectively, I think, into the renewable space. So I think it is very much important in this debate to highlight that the opportunities are there, but we need to take advantage of them, and we need to take advantage of them before ahead of others. And we do have a comparative advantage in this space if we move ahead. Let me now just talk a little bit about the financial side of things. And an important part of the transition is that the transition needs to be financed. It's not going, it's not going to just happen. It actually needs finance behind it. And at the moment, there's a very large pool of funds looking to finance those transition opportunities. And the GANZ Alliance that Mark Carney is chairing is, sitting on, according to Mark, at least $100 trillion worth of funds looking to be deployed in this space, which is a pretty large number. And it'd be useful if we could actually avail ourselves of some of those funds with some of these projects. So the capital needs to be deployed, and it needs to be deployed effectively. But for that to occur, there needs to be effective information to be able to make those decisions appropriately. And I think we still have some way to go in that space, both in Australia, but also globally. And again, this week in Glasgow, there's some important steps forward in that space. And one I would highlight is the TCFD, which is putting out much more granular information around disclosures. And a lot, as chair of the Council of Financial Regulators group on financing climate change, and together with ASIC, very much like to repeat the message that TCFD disclosures, we think, are the appropriate way for the Australian corporate sector to disclose their climate risks. TCFD, I think either probably later today, will announce with IFRS that they're moving ahead to move, to incorporate the TCFD disclosure disclosures into the global accounting standards. So this, we've seen a plethora of different propositions around disclosure, but I do think the world is now coalescing towards one, which is based on the TCFD, will be in the global accounting standards, and very much the path that we think Australian corporates should move down. And a number of them actually are, as of we think that around about 80 of the top ASX top 200 companies in Australia make TCFD disclosures. In many cases, they've got to them willingly, but in a number of cases, they've got there because they have no choice. The world, these companies have moved on from asking whether or not to disclose to the important question of how to disclose. And it is very important that we have that information out there in a comparable and consistent way, both within Australia and globally. So that is something that we, as the Australian financial regulatory community, are working with the corporate sector on, working with, particularly with the financial sector on, in getting that information, identifying those information gaps, and where we can, trying to redress those information gaps. And that's something we're certainly focusing on with APRA and the five largest Australian banks in the climate vulnerability assessment that we're conducting currently. And we're looking to have that information in the public domain not too far into the new year, which again should be a useful building block to inform those corporate disclosures. We at the Reserve Bank are looking at that particularly from providing a macro overlay to that climate vulnerability assessment, which again is something that many corporates have asked to have more guidance on. So we will be looking to put that out in the new year to provide that basis for consistency and the quality of disclosures by Corporate Australia. So let me finish there, Grant, but really highlighting this is a great opportunity for Australia. We shouldn't just be focusing on the costs of action by others or the costs of inaction, but very much focusing on the opportunities which are there in front of us. But that does need to be financed. And for that finance to be deployed effectively, we do need both usable and comparable information.
Guy, thank you very much for those comments. And I'd now like to pass on to Jennifer Westacott, the CEO of the Business Council of Australia. And Jennifer, over to you for some opening thoughts and comments.
Thanks, Grant. Look, I'm going to talk about the Business Council's plan to achieve net zero. I'm going to give a bit of a perspective on how business sees the opportunities that Guy and Brad have talked about and the challenges ahead and what business is doing in Australia to lead on climate action. A couple of weeks ago, the Business Council of Australia released its plan to achieve a net zero economy by 2050. I think our fundamental starting point is that the science is in, financial markets are moving, the global momentum is unstoppable. And there's tremendous consensus now in the business community that this represents much more of that opportunity. There's tremendous consensus about the importance of taking climate action. And there's a growing level of ambition and commitment to decarbonise Australian businesses. The issue is, of course, as others are saying, the how. We think that critical to this effort is to put in place a durable framework that brings forward investment and deployment of commercially viable technology now, especially in electricity, and then starts to send the investment signals to develop the technologies to decarbonise the harder to abate sectors and industries. So we've put forward a pretty comprehensive plan to do this. And I think it's important to say that our plan is backed by business, it's written by business, and it represents a broad cross-section of the economy, whether it's miners, generators, retailers, consumers, manufacturers, and financiers. We worked on this for 2 years. We consulted over 70 of Australia's largest companies. And so it's business's plan, effectively, because it's our view that business has to lead this change. So we've put forward a comprehensive architecture that we think is going to drive the right private sector investment. So it begins by government commitment to net zero to give that certainty. And obviously, the Australian government has taken that decision. We propose 10-year carbon budgets with 5-year reviews. We want to see a bigger ambition in the 2030 interim target. I'll talk about that in a minute. We want to see one of the major tools of the architecture in Australia that was called the safeguard mechanism ramped up to send a stronger investment signal to bring forward new technologies. We want to see a deepening of offset markets. We want to see a serious effort on investment in new technologies using the technology roadmap that the government has developed. We propose a low carbon regional roadmap so that we make sure that regional communities across Australia get the benefits of those opportunities that Guy spoke about. We believe we've got to constantly keep updating our adaptation strategy. And Grant, of course, we argue very strongly that your authority ought to be empowered to drive policy integration and coordination. Our paper really focuses on the underscoring that the importance is about coordination on that pathway to net zero. And we believe the absence of coordination will create friction in the system, which will create cost and inefficiencies. The good news about what we've put forward is it's very consistent with the government's existing architecture. It does push a few of the policies a bit harder, but we don't need to start from scratch. If I think about businesses' perspective on the changing economy, obviously there are two key challenges: to decarbonise the domestic economy and to continue to grow export opportunities. And I think as your paper points out, the Climate Change Authority's paper points out, it makes sense to start thinking about Australia being carbon competitive. And this is certainly how Business Council companies and large corporates in Australia are thinking. They understand that the traditional drivers of competition in global markets will now increasingly be about the carbon intensity of products. And then in respect of new export opportunities, Australia is, of course, abundant with natural endowment, solar, wind, critical rare earth minerals, which can all be taken advantage of to create scalable new export opportunities. But we believe the key to that is to move faster and to make the opportunities to reduce the cost burden in later years. So we've divided this into 2021 to 2030 and 2030 to 2050. So we say from now until 2030, we've got to really go harder. We've put forward quite an ambitious interim target of 46 to 50% by 2050 of 2005 baselines. And we think that's got to be about trying to bring forward the easy to abate sectors, including improvements in energy efficiency, obviously a vastly bigger penetration of renewable energy in the national electricity market. And companies tell me that's what they want to see, even in the industrial sector. They want to see a greater penetration of renewable energy so they can produce more competitive carbon products, greener products. And they believe that's an export opportunity with a competitive advantage. Now, we also say that's got to be balanced against the requirements for a reliable and secure grid. And then from 2030 to 2050, we need to focus on closing that technology gap for the harder to abate sectors, and by supporting the development and deployment of emerging technologies at scale. And that's really crucial to seize those export opportunities that Guy has talked about. So we've got to create those new industries, and they've got to be able to outperform today's exports in terms of scale and value. And so our companies are investing in hydrogen plants, green metals, lithium, nickel, rare earth minerals, and they're obviously going to be essential for that battery supply chain. But the good news is we believe you can scale this to comparable levels with today's exports. Like, just take Tesla alone. They're talking about potentially consuming more than $1 billion a year of Australian lithium, nickel, rare earth minerals, and that's just one company. The Grattan Institute estimates that Australian revenue from critical minerals by 2050 could be 2.5 times the revenue value for coal exports today. And then finally, just quickly, what is business doing? A quarter of ASX companies, or 50% of the collective market cap, is covered by net zero. Sorry, just have a bit of water. We talked about international investment trends, and I know Stephen's going to cover this. Sustainable bonds forecast by Moody's to grow by 32%. Pretty much every sector of the economy is now pushing hard. Global giants, Shell and BP, Australia's miners, BHP, Fortescue, Rio Tinto, the electricity generators, Energy Australia, Origin, AGL, and of course the manufacturing sector. And then the banks, of course, are starting to align their portfolios to that lending based on a net zero trajectory. And many, and your report makes this very clear, Grant, restricting finance to coal and other fossil fuel assets. So what does business need to really get this moving? The big risk is that investment and business trends run faster than government policy. And that risk of misalignment of government policy and business action will change the value of assets quite quickly and could be quite disruptive and lead to bigger adjustments. So we need a stable policy architecture from government that enables markets to run effectively and drives private sector investment. The private sector, of course, knows it has to do the transition. It doesn't expect government to make those investments, but government does have that facilitation role. That's why we are really focused on that greater policy coordination in our plan. And we have, of course, welcomed the government's commitment to net zero. That's now a bipartisan commitment, and that's of great certainty to the Australian business community. We use the government's current architecture. Obviously, we've made those changes to the safe, or proposing those changes to the safeguard mechanism. Just a couple of points, just to particularly pick up on Guy's point about reporting. We totally agree with Guy on this, but we want to see one reporting regime, not 50. And I think, you know, if we really want to get that transparency that Guy's talking about, we need to really get a coordinated effort here so that we've got one reliable source of information. And that's to regulators as well. What we can't have is multiple regulators requiring multiple disclosures in multiple different ways. That will just create additional cost and won't lead to the transparency that Guy's talking about. And the final thing is about governments and where they invest. Governments must co-invest very carefully. Where government intervention displaces private sector investment, That is not going to be helpful. That is going to push private sector investment out. And so we need governments intervening markets where there is technology that's not commercially viable, not government investment, where there are proven technologies, where there's proven private sector capability, because that will only displace private sector investment or government investment in assets which are not going to be able to increase in their commercial value. Again, that runs the risk of displacing private sector investment. So that's all from me, Grant. Back over to you.
Thank you, Jennifer, for that contribution as well. And we'll come back with some questions. There's a lot to think about there. I'd like to now hand over to Stephen. And Stephen, I know you bring some quite unique perspectives through your leadership through affirmative investment management. Happy to hand over to you to hear some comments and thoughts from your perspective.
Thanks, Grant. And I'm going to pick up on a couple of the themes that have already been discussed. And Brad mentioned the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, which came out in August this year. And we thought it painted a pretty sobering picture of the progress thus far in the world's efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And this recognition has led to an acceleration of the efforts to achieve net zero 2050, with commitments from both government and the private sector. The finance sector in particular has a critical role to play in this transition and has accelerated its focus, led by organizations such as the UN Principles for Responsible Investment. It's the finance sector that will fund the transition. For asset managers and asset owners, the commitment to net zero is different to ESG investment. It's a commitment to refocus the portfolios on that transition to net zero. It's forward-looking and focuses on positive selection of the leaders in that transition. This alliance is about ambitious targets, hard action plans, and transparent measurement, something that everyone's talked about. It will, however, also lead to companies and or governments that lack ambition or lack metrics being excluded from the investable universe, but primarily it's about positive selection. The transition and the capital flows to support it, I believe, will be one of the largest investment opportunities in both debt and equity of our lifetimes. The estimated cost of the transition has been referred to about $120 trillion. The net zero commitment for asset managers alone now stands at $50 trillion. When you combine that with other financial sectors through the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, we will be getting close to the total required to finance the transition. Investors are already demanding change. You see that in their investment choices, the rise of climate solution funds, the introduction of carbon budgets in conventional equity portfolios, and the rise of the impact fixed income market. The impact bond market will see another record year. It's been a record every year for the last 10 years. We'll see over $1 trillion of new issuance in 2021 across green, social, and sustainability bonds. Investors are also becoming more sophisticated in their decision-making, assessing both the issue itself and the use of proceeds, but also the issuer through an ESG lens, which includes the issuer's forward-looking commitment to net zero. Issuers that lag, and that includes sovereign bonds, will be excluded. Issuers have been excluded on their ESG standards, particularly around their support for the most polluting industries or lack of transition plan. And it's scope 3 emissions that count. But for issuers that lead, the demand is enormous. The recent Spanish green bond was 12 times oversubscribed. The recent UK green gilt was the most heavily oversubscribed gilt in history. Investors have developed clear criteria for assessing debt at the issue and the issuer level, as well as evidencing impact through project level assessment. And bondholders and equity holders, but bondholders engage with issuers to ensure they do deliver on those commitments. In the equity market, investors have a role through their investment selections, by exercising their voting rights, and through engaging with companies. The equity opportunities are in the enabling sectors around net zero, such as the technology, but also the equity of leaders in a transition to net zero who will benefit from higher market share, higher valuations or lower risk premium, as well as just simply more sustainable business models. The recent Climate Action 100 was the largest ever investor-to-company engagement process. 615 investors covering $60 trillion of assets under management engaged 167 companies, including the world's 100 largest emitters. It had a clear focus. Companies must set net zero targets and demonstrate a plan on how they will decarbonize, including the 2050, but also the 2030 plan. And it was focused on scope 3 emissions. It focused on their future capital and investment plans, as well as tying remuneration to the delivery of net zero. In the run-up to COP, these 615 investors wrote to governments around the world to say they support the transition to net zero and they were ready to allocate capital. Their requests of governments were their own 2030 and 2050 plans and policies designed to help them to deliver the targets, including, but not limited to, as Guy talked about, commitment to mandatory climate risk disclosures aligned to the TCFDs, carbon taxes, and perhaps carbon border adjustments. The opportunity is vast. The amount of capital that is to be allocated here is unprecedented. There will be both debt and equity opportunities in the technologies that enable transition, but also in the companies that lead, and in particular in those hard to abate sectors such as energy and shipping. We've already developed models to identify these leaders, particularly in the hard to abate sectors, as part of the launch of transition finance portfolios. And finally, and Guy referred to this, it's critical that this transition is a fair and a just transition. The short-term impacts of transition through the inevitable higher energy prices or decommissioning of fossil fuels often fall on the most vulnerable in society or the most vulnerable societies themselves. And we must ensure there are mechanisms in place to protect these peoples and these countries. Thank you, Grant.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you again for those great opening comments from Jennifer and Stephen. What I'd like to do now is begin to get a bit of a discussion going. And I'd like to do that by asking a question, and it's going to be the same question of each of you, because I'm sure each of you, listening to your opening comments, will bring different perspectives to it. Brad, in his capacity as CEO of the Authority, and myself as Chair, are actually very keen to learn as much as we can from you. So if Brad doesn't mind, I'm going to ask the others first and then see, in respect of each individual question, and see whether you have any comments you'd like to add. The first question I'd like to ask, for Guy's comments, Jennifer's comments and Stephen's comments, is around this question of policy and technology. And certainly the Australian government has a substantial amount of its policy position framed around technology and the development of technologies to assist this transition. The IEA would say, as perhaps even IPC, that the technology we need to get to ambitious 2030 targets largely exists. It would also say that much of the technology we get to net zero is yet to be developed. And for those who look closely at the IPCC work, beyond 2050, we've got to be actually sequestering carbon out of the atmosphere at the rate of many billions of tons a year. That technology is certainly a long way away. My question is, how do we fund it? We've talked about the massive amounts of, Stephen, you talked about the massive amounts of capital that are going to be allocated. And Guy, you've got a very high level macro view of the economy. But one of the challenges is getting investment in these technologies. And that's often small investments in small things that still have a long way to go. And there is, and I certainly know from my experience in trying to do this, that there's actually still a great difficulty in attracting funding to early stage R&D, yet we need that early stage R&D to get to net zero commitments. So my question of each of you, starting with Guy, is what needs to change in order to increase the flow of capital, not just to known and proven technologies for which we can see how that money might be supported through revenue streams, et cetera. But how do we actually drive money into R&D to actually develop the technologies we need to get to net zero by 2050? Just be interested in the perspective from each of you on that question, starting with Guy.
Thanks, Grant. I mean, to some extent in Australia, this has been the perennial question, as you've highlighted, and now it has a particular climate lens. And with this is issue has been looked at a number of times over the year, and probably most recently by Bill Ferris, in terms of why we don't have enough funding of R&D opportunities in Australia generally, let alone specifically in the climate space. But I suppose, and maybe picking up on something that Stephen said, at the moment we have those vast pools of capital looking specifically for opportunities in the climate space. And so it seems to me that there's a greater opportunity that those funds will be deployed into the sort of areas that you're talking about than may have been the case in the past. I suppose the other point to note is in my mind at least, there's a vast opportunity here to be realised. You don't know exactly which project's going to realise it, but you have a much better idea of the sector that the project's going to be occurring in than perhaps might have been the case in the past. I mean, Jennifer identified some areas, particularly around the grid, energy generation and the like, so we're not talking, a whole of economy issue here. We're looking, it's a bit more narrowly focused than it's been in the past, and those funds are looking to deploy in those particular areas. So, I hate to say this, but almost with any luck, we might actually find the investors lighting up with those looking for funds a little more than in the past, but because it's it's more narrowly focused. But that's perhaps being a little too optimistic. But to some extent, you're highlighting a question we haven't really resolved effectively in Australia for a number of years, but it has now a particular, more focused dimension to it, and maybe that gives us a better chance to resolve it, which is not a particularly concrete answer to your question, but I do think that the likelihood of investors actively seeking those opportunities probably is greater and much more focused than it's been in the past, which gives us a greater chance of actually happening.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen. To give you a practical example, and I'll then turn to Jennifer for her comments, but one of the great hopes for the world, and by the way, we should be extremely hopeful about technology and what technology can do, and when you're close to it, at an R&D level, it's just awesome what our research is coming up with. But the classic example in the Australian economy is solar, where Australian research led the development of photovoltaics and nearly all of the inventions that have driven down the cost of photovoltaics, yet we hardly participate at all in that industry in any sense of manufacturing or export income. And one of the great tragedies would be to actually miss the opportunities this brings. So, Jennifer, what's necessary in your mind to get a greater momentum out of business and investing in earlier stage R&D and trying to own for Australia some of the great opportunities? I don't think we should just see opportunities of more minerals or the like. I think there's a huge technology opportunity for Australia as well.
Yeah, and look, I think the technology opportunity is there. And, each time, we look at these technologies look more and more viable. But I think the first thing, and we call for this in our paper, is that we need a much more substantial commercialization translation fund. We really need to do what other countries have done, which is really put some serious grunt into that translation capacity, as you've talked about. The other point we make, Grant, in our paper is that the big policy tool the government's got, which is the safeguard mechanism, if you were to gradually and carefully lower those baselines, you immediately send that signal, particularly in the harder to abate sectors, and you do that with enough time for companies to start investing in those new technologies. And suddenly the investment equation about fossil fuel intensive technologies versus fossil fuel efficient technologies or zero carbon technologies or low carbon technologies, you've got to change that investment equation effectively. And that then of course leads to the sort of capital raising that Stephen and Guy have talked about. But I, we do believe you've got to put that policy signal there to change the relative value of low carbon technologies and carbon intensive technologies. And that in itself will start creating that investment pipeline, that drawing down of those capital products that Stephen has talked about. So it's a combination of things. And we know that when we've done this in the past, we are able to scale up those industries. But I don't think there's any one answer to this. But I do think from what people have said tonight and everything that we're starting to see around the world, that there is much more of an appetite to make these investments. And of course, the financial products that Stephen has talked about, same with the sort of signal that we're talking about from the safeguard mechanism, they all start to push companies to bring forward those technologies.
Thanks, Jennifer. So, Stephen, how do we get this massive pool of money to allocate just a little bit more to early stage R&D, get more into translational research and more technology to work for us more quickly?
Yeah. So, Grant, I actually do think it is happening in elsewhere in the markets that we're involved in Europe, in the UK and in the US. So I think it's absolutely possible to do that. A few years ago, it was really supported by mission-driven investors, you know, trusts, foundations and things, but more and more now it's in the mainstream as well. Although the size of some of these investments is sometimes relatively small. And it's also supported by government policies such as early stage venture capital schemes. So you've got to get the whole sort of overused word, but ecosystem working together. But there's certainly capital to be deployed in these areas. And one other thing I just add is I think also, and this is why it's so critical we engage with companies in traditional industries, particularly the hard to abate sectors, because a lot of the technology, a lot of the innovation is going to come from those companies. And so exclusions, simple exclusions from investment portfolios won't drive the transition we need to have. And we truly believe you need to engage. There will always be some level of exclusions in companies that don't have ambition, but those that have ambition and plans, engaging with them is where a lot of the innovation is going to come from.
Right. Thank you, Steve. Brad, did you want to add anything to those comments?
Thanks, Grant. I think Guy, you know, sort of identified that this has been a bit of a long-standing problem generally for us in Australia. I guess we have seen sort of in the renewable space with, I guess, some success with the Australian Renewable Energy Agency and then the Clean Energy Finance Corporation in bringing newer technologies to market, that where we can get a reasonable balance of risk sharing between the government sector and the private sector, you know, we do get some results. And so I guess there's a question in my mind about whether those models, you know, how well they could transfer across to some other, I guess, R&D areas as we look to sort of broaden our emissions reductions potential. So that's, you know, that's one question. And just, you know, how well do we collaborate, you know, across sectors between government, the private sector, and I think academia, you know, is another question that, you know, we can always keep looking at.
Thanks, Brad. I'd like to ask another question now, and again, of each of our panelists. All of you have talked about measurement in various ways, the need for more granular measurement, the importance of better, you know, statistics at a whole of economy level, and also, Jennifer, you mentioned absolutely the need for better information, but for heaven's sake, let's make it efficient and only have one standard for it. That's the first point. The second point is that we know, and certainly my sense is, that many corporates in their early commitments to greater ambition through 2030 and even on the path to net zero are relying a lot on offset markets, that is, sequestration in various forms. The third point is that we know that amongst the NGO community, greenwashing is a huge issue. And my question, which I'd like each of you to address, and I'll start with Stephen on this occasion because I know it's absolutely central to the integrity of the bond market, is this question of greenwashing and integrity. What is necessary to maintain integrity in, and I'm going to use broadly the term offsets, sequestration, whatever form you like, because without it, the task is orders of magnitude more difficult. But there are real risks to that lever being a big lever for us if it's corrupted in a sense by the way it's used. So if that question makes sense, Stephen, can we start with you and your thoughts on this question of integrity around some of these markets?
Yeah, the greenwashing is and has been an issue, particularly the impact fixed income markets historically have been generally self-labeled. So theoretically, anyone could issue a bond and call it a green bond. But I think investors are becoming more sophisticated in the way that they evaluate the issue, the use of proceeds, but also the issuer themselves against a set of criteria, and transparency around that is absolutely critical. But also investors are becoming more sophisticated in the way they evidence impact, building up impact metrics, particularly if they're building them from the project level up. So I think there's a lot more sophistication, which exposes then issues or issuers that perhaps are a slightly lighter shade of green than they should be. And so I think that is critical. On the point of data and metrics. I agree with all the panelists. It's critical we get more consistency in metrics. I can't imagine being a company, finance director, and the number of requests that you get for impact metrics, none of which are consistent. So I think there needs to be more consistency. I think regulators have a role there, as do the rating agencies. When we first started, there just wasn't any data available, and so we built our own database. But I think in 5 years' time, data hopefully is more commoditized, more freely available to allow investors to make informed choices on a more consistent basis.
Thanks, Steve. Jennifer, your thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, look, I think many companies, certainly the major corporations, are very conscious of this greenwashing issue, and they're very keen to make sure that we develop an integrity-based offset market and that we have a lot of transparency in that offset market, and that we make a very strong recommendation in our report that we've really got to improve the liquidity, transparency and integrity of our domestic offsets, and that ought to be a key first priority. And obviously then companies will want to access global offsets. But we do need a better system for companies to be able to see the relative value and integrity of those offset opportunities. And obviously we say in our document that increasingly, this is going to be part of trading arrangements, bilateral trading arrangements. And again, that ought to be subject to integrity, transparency, and very, very comprehensive reporting. But I'm pretty confident, Grant, that companies are very, very conscious of the greenwashing concerns. But that's not going to be solved by multiple reporting regimes. It's going to be solved by efficient reporting regimes that show that transparency and allow you to actually do proper comparisons across sectors, across companies, and allow you to see that people are indeed purchasing credible offsets. And I think the point that Stephen just made about financing, I think it is important that people are able to make genuine comparisons about companies that are able to reduce their emissions versus companies that default to an offsetting arrangement, even though those technologies are available to them.
Thanks, Jennifer. Guy, turning to you, and the same question, perhaps with an added twist, that as Jennifer mentioned, it's hard to imagine an effective offset market without having some, not just local, but broadly more global trading environment for it. And that brings in questions like free trade, border adjustment mechanisms and the like. Did you have any thoughts on this topic as to how we ensure the integrity of these markets and that these markets can play a critical role in our progress towards net zero?
Not sure I have too much insight on that, but let me take the broader question that you raised, though, lifted up to a slightly higher level and something I mentioned earlier. So I think to the point about a multitude of reporting arrangements, I don't think we're in that space. I think we're very rapidly moving out of that space in the environmental space, and it is around the coalescence around the TCFD reporting requirements. And as I said, so the previous TCFD requirements, which were out there before, they were nowhere near. They weren't very granular. They were very high level, a nice set of statements, but not a lot of guidance behind them. But the ones which are being released, which have been put out this week, are a lot more granular, and there's a lot less discretion as to how companies might take them forward. And then picking up on what I said earlier, if you combine that, combine them with the IFRS Foundation, and you get the accountants and the auditors on board, then you've coalesced around an auditable standard. And that's very much the intent here. Now, they are working on a very ambitious timeframe. It's not the 5 years that Stephen was talking about. It's actually, as I understand it, basically the middle of next year, which may be particularly ambitious, but that's the sort of timeframe we're talking about. So, and it is very much because we've got in mind this great uncertainty that we have out there in terms of, particularly from the investment community, trying to process all the, not particularly consistent disclosures which are out there. So I do think that issue is being very much addressed. It's been coordinated at the global level by the Financial Stability Board, which is very much behind that. So that's pretty much got all, that's effectively the global financials regulatory community behind that. So I do think that we are rapidly moving to one standard in this space, which I think reduces a number of problems. The one challenge, though, and a challenge particularly for Australia, though, is the related run around taxonomies. You know, which is probably more in Stephen's space, you know, what is a green investment and what isn't? And that's a challenge which I feel we've still got to address here in Australia. The Europeans and the Chinese have taxonomies which are out there now. They haven't yet been completely institutionalized into their financial systems to, you know, to basically direct the investment decisions of European or Chinese investors, but we're not far away from that. But those taxonomies are not necessarily suitable for the Australian economy or in the Australian financial system. And I think there is a challenge there, which we as the Australian regulatory community are taking up with the Australian financial community and through bodies like ASFI to actually look at how we can develop an Australian taxonomy, which is, and it's got to be consistent with those others, because there's no point in everyone, to Jennifer's point, having their own bespoke taxonomy. That's not going to be very helpful. So we've got to probably basically use that as a starting point, but, you know, just make it more, you know, adapt it for the Australian circumstance. And I think that's a challenge which we've probably, you know, again, we haven't got a lot of time that we can delay on, because those other ones are going to be there in front of us, and we can't just say we don't like it. We've got to have a credible alternative to that.
Brad, this is quite a strong thematic for the CCA, and some work has been commissioned in this regard. Do you want to make a brief comment and then I'll move on to the next question?
Thanks, Grant. Yeah, so we're very interested in the question of the sequestration potential that we have here in Australia, and hence, you know, how that might contribute to the level of offsets that we have available to use. And I think, you know, that will help us, you know, understand what we need to achieve with emissions reductions more directly. And I guess we have a strong focus on integrity as well. And that's, you know, that partly reflects the work we do with our statutory responsibilities, reviewing the Emissions Reduction Fund and the arrangements there. So I think that sort of ties together fairly neatly in terms of our focus. And, you know, just to underscore the importance of the integrity of offsets, you know, we absolutely need to ensure that they are robust, that if we're going to have, you know, one tonne of emissions over here, and we're going to use an offset, we just have to be absolutely sure that that offset is genuine. You know, otherwise we're just kidding ourselves that we're making progress. I guess the other point to make would be simply that we want to put as much zero into net zero as we can, so that, you know, we're not overly relying on offsets. And that sort of ties back to your earlier point that, you know, down the track, with the strong likelihood that we're going to overshoot a little bit on what we're trying to achieve with global warming, that we will need negative emissions technologies and sequestration potential to deploy with those.
Thanks, Brad. We have a bit less than 5 minutes left, and I'd like to ask two more questions, so we're going to need some brief answers. I'll give you forewarning of the second question. I'd like each of our panellists, particularly Guy, Jennifer and Stephen, to just think of the answer to the question. If there was one thing more important than all others that we could change that would help us on this path to net zero, what would it be from your perspective? That's the question you get with notice. The question without notice, and I'll start with Steve and then go to Jennifer. Even the IPCC work and the IEA work says the world will still be using fossil fuels in 2050 at the rate of about 20% that we do today. My simple view of the world is this, that if fossil fuels deplete, but if they deplete more quickly, given the lack of unwillingness to invest in them now, then demand reduces, then supply will be tight and price will go up. It's difficult to know today whether the higher prices we're seeing and some of the energy issues we're seeing in some Northern Hemisphere economies are just volatility or trends. But at the end of the day, the world will still need a substantial amount of fossil fuel. Stephen, how's that going to be funded? And who's going to fund?
Thanks, Grant. It's going to be a challenge. I think, you know, and particularly as some larger companies divest of their more polluting assets to meet their own net zero commitments, who are going to be the buyers of these assets? And there will be buyers, and it's not reasonable to expect companies to decommission assets that actually have financial value. But the universe will be small, and financing around it will be difficult to get. And many of these assets require leverage to be viable. So I think as we move forward and with the potential for stranded assets, finding who are going to be responsible owners of these assets will become more and more challenging. Hopefully that is just going to accelerate the technologies and the move to renewables, but there may be transition fuels in certain sectors that are still fossil fuels that will be a transition fuel which is viable for things like shipping.
Thanks, Sam. Jennifer, unfortunately I need a quick answer, but in representing corporate Australia, many corporates are having to choose all in or all out. And Stephen's evidence some companies are choosing the all out, but of course some have clearly chosen to be all in. They have in fact doubled down on their investments in fossil fuels through corporate, you know, through mergers and acquisitions, etc. Any thoughts on this topic as to how it's going to be funded?
I think this is going to be the really difficult topic, as Stephen's just said, but we are going to have to find a transition way through here, because it's simply the case that there are these very hard to abate sectors and they will still need to be able to continue to operate. The question, I think, for finances is, are people making a genuine effort to decarbonise and to make their processes and products more efficient versus just ruling things out just for kind of philosophical reasons? And I think that's going to be the dilemma of the financier, I guess, and the dilemma of those companies who really can't get to those easy to abate sectors. They can't get the technological change.
And it does lead to the question as to whether the investors in those assets are not going to follow the same rules that we'd like the rest of the world to follow.
Exactly.
Time doesn't permit. Very quick answer to my last question. I'll start with Guy. If you could change or suggest that we focus on one thing above all others to help us on this journey towards net zero, Guy, any thoughts on that?
Yep. So this is a global problem. So I think a global solution is what's required. So if I had one thing, it would actually be agreement at the global level. I mean, that's probably a vain pie in the sky hope, but actually, given it is a global problem, it does necessitate a global solution. So hopefully we see some aspect of that this week.
Jennifer?
Alignment and seeing this through the prism of opportunity. If we could get this debate onto an opportunity discussion, I think we could actually start to really move things.
Thanks, Jennifer. Our report was titled From Cost to Competitive Advantage, so we agree. Stephen, your thoughts on the matter?
I think more education of investors, underlying investors in superannuation plans and mutual funds, they're going to drive this. And it's not just the young investors. What we've seen is it's right through the age bracket of investors. And I'm very positive because they're driving the change.
Thanks, Stephen. Brad, time has got past us, so you can give me your answer later when we next catch up. Is that okay, Brad? Yeah, thank you. If I could just thank our panellists very much. Guy, firstly to you, really appreciated the time and contribution you've made tonight. Thank you very much. Jennifer, the same. Welcome your report. It's a big step for the BCA to do through all of that work to put that report on the table. And appreciate that contribution and your efforts here tonight. Thank you very much. And Stephen as well, with what you've done with Affirmative Investment Management. You've been a real leader in this space, and hopefully you'll be benefiting from that foresight. So well done, and thank you very much for joining us tonight. Brad, thank you for the work done in preparing this report, to you and the team more broadly, and for hosting and organising this session. Hopefully those that have viewed it live, it's been useful, and for those that will, I'm sure, view it at their own leisure, and it will be repeated in the pavilion, I think, during the course of COP26. I hope you enjoy the session and the discussion we've had tonight. Thank you very much again for everybody for participating. Thank you and good night.